listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this broadcast, which is live, we invite you to interact with us on our chat feature here on the EmotionalPro.com radio page. And you're also invited to call us on our toll-free number, which is 800-630-7858. That's 800-630-7858. And you can ask our guest directly whatever questions you have. Who is in charge of your family? Psychologist Dr. Dathan Paterno says somebody is, and it may not be the parents. For nearly two decades, Paterno's been helping families to restore parents to what he believes is their rightful place firmly at the head of their own families. In his book released this year, Desperately Seeking Parents, Paterno promises to tell you why your child needs a parent in charge and how you can become one. He advocates that parents are meant to be vital, valid sources of love and authority for their children and minces no words in telling his readers why and how to use the family constitution, a vehicle for reinstalling parents at the head of their own families. So we're talking today about how parents have lost their head of family status, what they need to do to restore themselves to this position, and what benefits children accrue when they do. He believes that parents best serve their children by establishing and maintaining an appropriate hierarchy and by holding all children to very high standards of behavior. Dr. Dathan Paterno is a licensed clinical psychologist practicing just outside of Chicago. Having honed his expertise with children and adolescents for over 18 years in psychiatric hospitals, therapeutic day schools, residential treatment centers, and private practice, he is currently clinical director of Park Ridge Psychological Services, a private practice that serves children, adolescents, and their families. And you can find him on the web at www.desperatelyseekingparents.com. Dr. Dathan Paterno, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So what's the problem here, Dr. Paterno? As a psychologist practicing with children with problems like this for a couple of decades, what outcomes or issues have drawn you to look at the situation about parents being in charge of their families?
Probably the biggest problem that I see in my office is what I see in public also, that parents have lost their grip on their homes, on their children, and inadvertently they've allowed the children to kind of wag the dog, so to speak. Children are taking up the vacuum of power from the parents and winding up in charge of their parents. I see far too many children who are disrespectful and disobedient, that have poor manners and aren't as safe, and they're not contributing to the home like they should be, and parents don't really know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly, in my own practice, I see a lot of that also, and also families, parents that feel like they don't have a right, like they're going to damage their children if they step in to being in charge. Do you run into that?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the fundamental problems is, just like you said, that parents are afraid of their children. They're afraid of breaking relationship with their children by using discipline, as if disciplining their children would result in the children running away or losing alliance or love. And it's the exact opposite. Parents need to understand that their children are desperate for them to provide limits and sometimes say no, and sometimes take away privileges if the children aren't behaving properly. They want to be guided. They want to be trained. They know intuitively that they need that. And when parents don't offer that, children generally don't say, hey, Mom, Dad, I need more limits. But their behavior says that.
Well, my learning is that children need a container for while they're growing up. They need to be contained, and the container, of course, would be moving out slowly throughout childhood.
Right.
Because otherwise their feeling experience is that they're alone in the world, that it actually is fear-inducing.
Exactly. I mean, throughout the years of training, we need to take the parental limits, and like you say, the container, and children start to internalize that by the time they're adults. And so they have that self-containment that they can use to go out into the world and be reasonably safe. But until that time, parents need to contain that. And that's why I talk about being in charge or being in control of the child without controlling them.
Uh-huh. Well, you start out in Desperately Seeking Parents talking about the fact that there are two types of parents, the wimpy and the in charge. Will you tell our audience what you mean by these two?
Well, I one of the good metaphors for that is Captain Von Trapp and Maria. I think every family has one parent who's a little bit more like Captain Von Trapp. It's obedience uber alles, and they're stricter and they tend to be the bad cop. And they may err on the side of discipline without love and affection. And then on the other side is Maria, who was very loving and very affectionate and praised fun and stressed all of that, but didn't have a lot of discipline. And I think there needs to be a balance. But the wimpy parent tends to be more passive. They tend to be more afraid of the child. They tend to be afraid to produce limits, and they're not as consistent. That's the wimpy parent. And then the opposite is the more the bad cop or the more aggressive parent, the Captain Von Trapp, who tends to have all limits all the time, all discipline, without the love and affection that children absolutely must have.
Thank you. Thank you. And sure. And then what's the difference in what happens with children, whether they have a wimpy or an in-charge parent? I want to look at what's the outcome for them, because they're being prepared for adult life. So moving through childhood and into adult life, what's the difference in what they get or don't get from such parents?
Well, one of the biggest differences that children who have kind of a wimpy parent, they have so many privileges that don't have to be earned. And that's one of the biggest problems with kids today. Talk about the difference between rights and privileges. And children who have parents who are kind of wimpy don't make their children earn those things, such as electronics, such as sleepovers, such as desserts, such as late bedtime, board games, all the fun stuff that kids like to do that they should basically be earning. And when you don't have to earn your privileges, they begin to be perceived as rights. And then when real life comes in and you have to earn things, children are ill-prepared for that. They don't have a template for that. They're used to getting things without earning it. So that's one of the biggest problems that I see, is that children have this sense of gross entitlement. And I know that a lot of parents have reflected that to me, too, that they see the kids today are much more entitled than kids in previous generations. So that's one of the negative consequences of that kind of parent.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remind me that I lived as a single parent for 20 years, raising a son and a daughter, and my son at one point wanted a computer, and he kept advocating he should have a computer. We lived in Marin County, California, which is a very wealthy county, and a lot of his peers were just handed things, very...
Sure.
A lot of things at that time. And so he wanted me to get him a computer, and I said, I appreciate that you want a computer, but I haven't seen you make any effort to create it yourself. And he said, well, what are you talking about? Well, you have to put some energy. You have to learn that you have to put some energy into getting something for yourself if you really want it. And he looked at me defiantly and said, well, if you won the lottery, wouldn't you buy it for me? And I said, absolutely not. So,
right. And what that does is it shows that children don't naturally have a behavior consequence connection, meaning that they don't understand that certain behaviors get certain consequences, both positive or negative. And when we make children earn privileges, then they see that they are empowered. They see that what I do can get me some things that I want, either positively or negatively. And that's a really important lesson for children to learn.
you know, when he got older, he's 33 now, and when he got older in his early 20s and went to work in corporations, he actually worked in computers. He told me one day that the company for which he worked was just filled with people who had brilliant ideas every day, all day long. And then he said, but Mom, most of them don't know how to bring them into reality.
Mm.
And that's an interesting, you know, down the way kind of thing that occurs. Now, you used something that you call in Desperately Seeking Parents a bad word. You use the word consequences. So let's go into consequences. What do you mean by consequences?
Well, consequences, like you said, is a four-letter word in our culture today, but literally just means within the sequence. It means that something comes after something else. So if I do A, then the consequence or what will happen after that is B. If I ask for a cookie, I may get one or I may not. If I throw a fit, my parents might reward me by paying attention to me, or they might ignore me, or they might send me to time out. And so the consequence just means what happens after a certain behavior. And a lot of children don't recognize that their behavior will produce a consequence, either because the parent doesn't give them a regular consequence or it's inconsistent. And so they don't understand that when I do a certain behavior, there will be a predictable event to occur after that. And when children don't have that, the world seems random to them, and they don't seem empowered with their behavior.
So actually providing consequences or making sure that the child is aware of the consequences, experiences it, it actually is building that child's sense of power, internal power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. My child knows that if they want something, they have to do something first. They have to ask in a particular way with good manners. They have to say please and thank you and all that. Or they have to do a certain chore first. Or they have to finish their homework first. Something like that. And that makes them feel empowered. I know that I can get what I want, not by throwing a fit, but by doing certain positive behaviors. Because I trust my parents, who are consistent, that when I do what I'm supposed to do in the right way, I get what I want fairly often. Not always, but fairly often. Because in the past, over many repetitions, when I've done the right thing, they've given me something positive, either their attention or, you know, a certain reward. And reward is just one type of consequence. It's not the main type of consequence. Punishment is another type of consequence. Ignoring the child is another type of consequence.
Huh. I just want to mention, I think I have the poster family for you in my daughter who lives in North Carolina. She has three children, 14, 13, and 11. And the working in some of the ways you describe has netted them some very powerful children who do things like stand up for other kids at school. Last year, they made all straight A's all together in one semester. Everybody made A's and everything. So they were producing well. They feel good about themselves. They're going forward in their world. And I think that's what you're talking about here. What kind of benefits can accrue to getting back in charge as a parent. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think that when we have parents who are in charge of their children without being too controlling over them, then we build children who are independent, who are self-empowered, and they feel good about themselves and confident going into the world. And they feel so confident in themselves that they can look outside of themselves as well. We don't want to build narcissistic children who are just looking out for constant reward. But when you give them reward, appropriate rewards, and you build them up in self-empowerment, they can feel secure enough in themselves that then they have more to give, and then they look outward. Then they start to be charitable. Then they start to be helpful to other people because they're so secure in themselves.
Yes, I definitely can see that. Well, now, you're in Desperately Seeking Parents, you're devoted to helping parents move from wimpy to in-charge parenting through the use of the family constitution. And I noted that it seems like you have a lot of faith in there being plenty of parents who are wimpy. And so I wondered, in your experience, about what percentage of parents would you say are wimpy?
Well, the ones that are in my office, it's a very high percentage. The ones that go through the bookstore is probably not as high. But I tell you, the vast majority of parents whom I see in my office whose children are struggling with obedience and respect tend to be wimpy parents. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some parents out there who are on the opposite end of the spectrum, who are the authoritarians, who are all discipline all the time with no love and affection. And those kind of parents also can produce difficult children who don't feel respected and who don't have enough freedom when they have earned it. And those kind of kids tend to be very rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of children that I see have parents who tend to be fairly wimpy.
Mm-hmm. So let me just point out, Doctor, that you have been traveling, and as often happens, your flight was delayed, and so we may hear some background noise because you are being very responsible and appearing on the program, it sounds like, perhaps from the airport. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm waiting by the baggage claim. So there are a few people looking at me on my cell phone talking about wimpy parents.
They're taking it personally.
Exactly. So, they may think that I'm talking about them.
So how did it happen? I think you talk about you go into the fact that we didn't used to raise children in the way that we do, a lot of people do today, the wimpy approach. That they're, previously, things were much more hierarchical. And so you have a series of things like divorce and child abuse legislation and so forth that have affected parents moving in this direction. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, please.
Sure. Well, the divorce rate, even though it's kind of leveled off in the past 20 years or so, is still very, very high. And so we do have a lot of parents who are raising children on their own. And as you can attest, and as I can attest, having grown up with a single parent, it's very difficult to provide that container when you're doing it on your own. It's possible. It's very possible, but it's very difficult to do that. So that's one of the issues, particularly when you have divorced parents who aren't civil with each other. That's incredibly difficult. When you have one parent who wants to provide limits and the other parent is more concerned about being liked, they tend to undermine the parent. Yes, they tend to undermine the parent who's trying to be in control and in charge because they want to be liked so much. And I see that quite often, where one parent is more devoted to being liked than being respected and being loved and honored for doing the right thing. They just want to be liked for being what I call the Disney dad, which is taking them places and buying them things. And then one parent is left to be the bad cop doing all the limit setting, and that really undermines their authority.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. I also talk a lot about the media, how, you know, in generations past, we had really good models for parents who were united, not just necessarily married, but they were united in the discipline and love, and they were on the same page, so to speak. And I know that that phrase is overused in our culture, but I haven't really found one that's better. They're united, they're on the same page about limits and expectations, and that provides a more solid container for the child. And that certainly has gone by the wayside. I mean, if we watch some of the programs that kids are watching today, parents are buffoons, and they're not to be respected or trusted. And I think that really undermines the relationship between parent and child. That's a big problem. Yes, I do talk about child abuse legislation. We took a problem that is significant, and that's child abuse. And we tried to solve that by saying that parents need to never abuse their children. And we went a little bit too far with that, I think, in saying that parents need to be afraid to discipline their children, because a lot of parents err on the side of not disciplining in fear of being seen as abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been a big problem. And what I say is that the state didn't replace what you can't do with what you should do. And so a lot of parents are just doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, one thing you didn't include there, but I might add, is the whole self-esteem movement. That one of the things that I noticed in self-esteem, people get parents get concerned that they'll damage their children's self-esteem by asking too much of them. And in the parenting work that I have done, my learning is that one of the building blocks of self-esteem is responsibility.
Yes, I absolutely agree that asking too little of your children communicates to them that they are able to do little. And if anything's going to crush a child's sense of self-worth, it's communicating to them that we don't trust you and we don't think that you can do things, so we're not going to expect it of you. I think that's incredibly damaging to children. And I think that psychologists are in particular guilty of this. Instead of saying that you are able, we have made almost every behavior or emotion a disability.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go into...
And I know that's highly controversial, yeah.
I want to go into that more deeply. It's time for us to take a break right now, but that is the very next thing I have on my list to ask you about. So let's talk about the disease, disorder, disability discussion, okay, when we come back?
Sure.
We're talking today with Dr. Dathan Paterno, who's author of Desperately Seeking Parents, and you can find him at desperatelyseekingparents.com. This is Full Power Living, and we will be right back.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Right. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements before we get back into talking with Dr. Paterno. Whatever you're doing, make sure to take time to download episodes of Full Power Living so you can listen to the most cutting-edge information on all areas of life that are impacted by emotions that we have amassed for you. And you can subscribe on iTunes by using my name, Eileen Dillon, I-L-E-N-E-D-I-L-L-O-N. Next week, we feature Shefali Sabari with another approach to parenting. She's author of The Conscious Parent. And also in October, we have Lynn Austin, who has written a wonderful book, Dispensing Wisdom to Children, called Edith Ann Marie, The Son is in My Heart. And Dr. Jeffrey Mason is returning to talk with us about his latest book, The Dog Who Wouldn't Stop Loving. And I had the pleasure of meeting the dog that inspired that book when I visited with Dr. Mason in New Zealand. So check the top of our radio page on emotionalpro.com for a fuller listing of upcoming guests and their topics, and join us for these fabulous explorations. And don't forget, we've got two internet radio programs that I co-host with life coach Dakey Fox on the Women's Information Network. That's the winonline.com, T-H-E-W-I-N online.com. Those are Building Conscious Families and Emotionally Speaking. And you're invited to participate in Emotionally Speaking, where women are speaking out about emotions on a personal, work, or worldwide basis, how emotions fit in all of those areas. And just contact me, Eileen, at emotionalpro.com if you'd like to participate, joining us on a chat and then being broadcast on the radio. And you can do it with an assumed name, too, in case you don't want everybody in your family to know exactly how you feel about things. So thanks for telling your family and friends about Full Power Living and for being a part of our mission of awakening the world to the power importance and importance of human emotions. So today we're talking with clinical psychologist Dr. Dathan Paterno, who's the author of a new book, Desperately Seeking Parents. He's advocating putting parents in charge of the family and reinstituting a family hierarchy that asks more from children than a large percentage of families today ask. So before the break, Dr. Paterno, we talked about the fact that a lot of parents don't take charge of their families in the way you're advocating because of the issues of disease, disorder, and disability. So will you give us a brief rundown of what that's all about?
Sure. There's two extremes. One is expecting somebody to do something that they're simply not capable of. For example, I'm almost 6 foot tall, but there's no way that I could dunk a basketball. And so if I went to a gym and somebody got on my case because I couldn't dunk a basketball, that would be cruel because I'm not tall enough and I can't jump high enough. It's not a skill or effort problem. If it were, then pushing me and holding me accountable might make sense. The opposite extreme is to say that a person is capable, but we don't hold them to the high standard. And we talked a little bit about that before. And I think that sometimes happens when we misdiagnose problems such as ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder and some learning disorders, is that we presume that somebody is not capable when they probably really are or would be if we trained them properly and were patient enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, like you said, the discussion you have is a bit controversial. I happen to be married to a doctor, a brain surgeon, mm-hmm. and he absolutely swears there is no such thing as ADD and ADHD, and oppositional defiant disorder is a kid who's out of control. And you seem to be very much in sync with that. Can you talk a little bit about your take on this?
Yes, I would definitely agree with your husband. I think that these are made-up disorders to describe something that's very real. Now, experientially, there are many children who struggle to pay attention. There are many children who are highly disorganized and can't follow through with things, and they have low motivation, or they struggle to read no matter what the teacher does or what the parent does. That part is very real. And so if we want to label that in some way, that's fine. I have no problem, you know, using words efficiently to describe things. But to presume that they're silly and the science doesn't support it. Now, we can look at brains of children who have been diagnosed with ADHD or the brains of children who supposedly have learning disabilities and see that there are differences in the brain. There's no doubt about that. But what scientists often, where they err, is saying that the causal relationship is from A to B rather than B to A. For example, if I grow up in a home where I'm not taught properly, the part of my brain that's supposed to develop to read properly is not going to grow, and it's not going to fire, and that's going to show up on an MRI or a SPECT scan. And so, yes, you may see brains that are different, but that doesn't mean that the brain problem caused the behavioral problem. Oftentimes, it's the reverse. And so labeling somebody with a neurological disorder, I think, ultimately does the child great harm in the long run.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of my children had some of these difficulties of being able to pay attention, being able to organize, and so forth. And I didn't go for a diagnosis. What I went for was seeing that he had some difficulties, and therefore I equipped him with skills to deal with those difficulties, and it didn't develop into a diagnosis.
Well, good for you. I think I wish a lot more parents would do that, because that empowers you to recognize how much power you have in your child's life. And your child recognizes that when you recognize that, okay, the container that I thought that I needed for my child needs to be a different shape, or it needs to be a little firmer, or it needs to have different sides. And you changed your container for your child, and your child developed beautifully because of that. He or she responded well to that. that's such an empowerment for family. And I think that so many parents give up too easily, not because they want to, but because I think scientists, psychologists and psychiatrists in particular, sell them a bill of goods that we have a quick fix for you. If your child's struggling, they have a brain problem, and you're not doing the right thing by not getting it treated medically.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that perhaps parents don't have enough information about this. I remember traveling to Hawaii. I was at Tripler Medical Army Center, and the head of the psychology department came out. I was waiting for a friend with my 2-year-old daughter, who was incredibly active. And this man observed her for a while, and he said, "Madam, you know, some people would call your child hyperactive." And I just looked at him and said, "Yes, I know they would, but I prefer just to think that she has a lot of energy." And, you know, right there was a place where my child could have been taken as a having something wrong with her, as opposed to having whatever she had, which was something that we could deal with. And aren't we, in your opinion, also facing some of that in schools? If a child can't sit still, we need to medicate them, as opposed to learning how to keep them interested.
Of course, I think, you know, a lot of teachers, I would say the vast majority of teachers are committed, absolutely committed, to doing the best that they can to teach children. And I don't want to throw teachers under the bus at all, but they have an incredibly difficult job. They are taking a number of children from varied backgrounds who may or may not be emotionally and neurologically and intellectually ready to learn, and trying to teach them all in very similar ways. I mean, we have a very difficult, I think, public school environment where teachers are supposed to teach kids all the same. And that's just ridiculous, because kids are all different. We have left brain kids and right brain kids. We have hyperactive kids. We have hypoactive kids. We have kids who are highly creative and kids who are very linear. We have kids who are concrete and kids who are abstract. And we have social kids. We have all kinds of kids. And yet we're supposed to all sit down, be quiet, listen exactly the same way. That doesn't make any sense. And so, that, and then when you combine that with the difficulty that parents have in training their children, and then we send them to school to learn, boy, I tell you, I really tip my hat to all the teachers who are doing their very best, and I can understand why they get frustrated. And I can understand their impulses just to say, whatever we have to do, change this child so that the child can fit the classroom better. I understand that impulse, but it's the wrong impulse. The impulse should be, let's find out what's going on with this child so that we can get the child more prepared for school. And what can I do at school to help child fit here better, rather than changing the child? I think the fundamental problem is seeing the problem with the child, rather than a mixture of what's wrong with the child's home, what's wrong with the child sometimes, what's wrong with the teaching pedagogy that I can maybe shift a little bit so that it fits the child better.
That's a very good discussion. Thank you. I grew up in a military family, and there was no question of hierarchy. My father sought to control every aspect of my life. He demanded that I make top grades. In fact, my sister made a C in chemistry in high school, and he made her take it over. He expected polite behavior, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Yes, sir. No, sir. He insisted that I do chores and care for my siblings. He set me to work making money starting at age 9, and he punished me severely for transgressions of what he expected me to be or the ways he instructed me to behave. And that was a crushing way to grow up. So the question that I have for you is, how do in-charge parents determine the level of control that they exert?
Great question. I think you're talking about the authoritarian rather than being authoritative. Obviously,
absolutely.
There's a good Goldilocks sweet spot that parents need to have. If you have love without discipline, I think that's the wimpy parent. If you have discipline without love and affection and balance and flexibility and understanding the child's level of development, then you have the authoritarian. Okay. And I think that's what you're talking about. So focusing on discipline so much that you ignore a child's emotional and intellectual and relational needs is the child's not going to fear you in a respectful, awe-inspired way. It's just going to be, how can I avoid punishment? And that's never, ever, ever going to encourage a child to grow in a healthy way. And it's certainly not going to endear the child to the parent in a way that they want to continue relationship after adulthood. So I highly recommend that parents say that love and discipline have to be dual paths that go at the same time and at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you an example.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I give you an example of where we see that at the dinner table? The passive parent says, the child can eat whatever he or she wants. He knows what his body wants, and if he wants to eat nothing but dessert, that's fine. He'll figure it out on his own. My kid knows what they need. Okay, that's the passive parent. The authoritarian parent says, you will eat every bite that I put on this plate. You will not leave the table until you have eaten every bite on this plate. I don't care if you have to stay here overnight. And then the authoritative or in charge parent says, you can eat whatever you want, but here's what you must eat in order to have dessert. You can have dessert, but only if you eat your vegetables, for example. I'm not going to make you eat anything, because if you're not hungry, you're not hungry. I want you to, listen to your body, because the authoritative parent understands that there needs to be some flexibility there and not absolutely controlling, okay? So I don't control what my kids eat, but I say that you can't have dessert unless you eat a certain amount of your food or your vegetables. And so that allows the child choices.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's empowering.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Well, I told you I grew up in an authoritarian family with my father in the military, and you say that often when somebody grows up in such a family, they try to make up for extreme parenting. And I did do some of that. I did sort of than I really needed to do. But it didn't take me long to realize that if I was not in charge and the head of the family, then things turned hellish pretty fast. And however, I had the belief that my children needed not so much my authority as they needed to develop their own authority over themselves as they were growing up, so that they had something to take with them when they went into the world. And I'm having a hard time putting what you're saying together with that approach. Can you do that for me?
Help me understand. I need to know a little bit more about what you mean about their own authority. I mean, when I talk about authority, I talk about an objective set of values and virtues that I am indeed trying to plug into my children, that I hope we model for them, sell them on the idea that these are good virtues to have. I can't make them have those values and virtues, but I want to do a very good job of selling them on the idea that humility, for example, and hard work and sharing and all self-discipline, all of those things will get them what they want. And that when I show them enough times that my life works pretty well and my wife's life works pretty well that way, and that we've guided them to see that their life works better when they use those things, that then they can latch on themselves and buy into it and say, hey, I think I've learned some good things here. It's worked out pretty well for me. When I go out on my own, I'm going to use those myself and make them my own and tailor make them and individualize them for my own life.
Well, I think there's a lot of value in that. I especially the modeling part, and definitely I did behave that way. However, I think what the differentiation is that I attempted to teach my children more through their own experience than me telling them or trying to teach them. My signature story, for example, I'll tell you very briefly, is when my son at age 8 stole a candy bar And when he came home, I asked him what he'd learned. He said that stealing wasn't worth it. I then asked him how he got into doing it, and he told me that two boys suggested it, and he got caught, and they didn't. And so I said, you mean you listened to two voices from outside of you and did what they said? Was there ever any other voice that you heard? And he said, yes. And I said, well, whose voice was that? What did it say? And he said, I think it was my voice. And it said, don't do it. It's not a good idea. And I said, well, if you could go back and live today over again, would you make the same choice or would you make a different choice? And he said, I'd listen to my own voice. I wouldn't listen to other voices. Whereupon I told him, I think that if you learned that stealing's not worth it and it's better to listen to the voice coming from inside of you than from voices outside, then I think you had a very valuable day and I'm proud of you. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what happened as a result of that is he really got in a one trial learning about stealing. Mm-hmm. I have checked with him numerous times. He never stole again. And it wasn't about me reacting or me telling him.
Right. It sounds like he had a natural instinct to pay attention or at least be aware that there was that voice. And so your role was to allow what was inside of him to come out. You know, the true education, educare, is to bring out of the child, not to put into the child. Uh-huh. And so sometimes, especially with moral development, I think kids do have a natural tendency to have some of those ideas. And then there are some natural consequences, such as shame and guilt and, you know, looking twice at what you do. And if you can just simply guide them and let them learn their own lessons from that, I think that's wonderful.
Good. And so that fits with the hierarchical model, however?
I would say it's not inconsistent. I mean, if a child doesn't, for example, let's say that your son didn't have that inner voice. If he didn't say to himself or to you, you know, I had another voice that told me that that was not there, then you would kind of be in a place where you'd either have to say, boy, I hope he finds that inner voice at some point, or we're going to have to provide an outer voice. Because, I mean, for example, if my inner voice tells me that you know, when I drive today, the expressway is the Autobahn, and I can drive however fast that I want to, because I want to. There's a selfish part of me that would like to drive 100 miles an hour. Well, I could certainly do that, and I may or may not ever have a one trial learning. That one trial learning might be getting in a car accident and dying. If I don't have that, I do sometimes need to rely on speed limits. And that speed limit is the extrinsic motivator that says, you know what, if you want to, you know, go by your inner instinct, there's going to be a consequence. Either you're going to get in an accident or you'll be punished. And the fact that happens provides an external reality that I can either ignore or pay attention to. But life circumstances have told me through repetition that when I get caught, I have to pay a fine. And therefore, there's a reason for me not to speed. So sometimes the inner good in me, the kind of natural good instinct that I have, will help me learn lessons. But sometimes that's not reliable. And I think where it's not reliable is where parents and teachers and other adults have to provide that extrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good clarification. We're up to our second break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the four expectations, the four rewards, and the constitution for the family. Okay, so we're going to be learning more about Dr. Paterno's approach to putting parents back in charge when we return. This is Full Power Living, and I'm your host, Eileen Dillon.
Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger, but if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. We're back with Dr. Dathan Paterno, author of Desperately Seeking Parents. So, Dr. Paterno, you are very clear. You have a whole system that you eventually incorporate into the family constitution. And I'd like you to talk about that system, how it works together with those with the four rewards and the four. I'm missing that word.
The consequences? The four expectations and the
four expectations. There you go. I don't know. I'm not going to blame this on age. I couldn't think of it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, understand that this system is for parents who are trying to reclaim an out-of-control situation. I don't necessarily believe that parents who are starting out absolutely need to do something like this. Most parents don't need to be this rigid and concrete with their parenting. Some parents are very natural at providing limits, and they know where they need to provide limits and where they need to provide freedom for their children. They don't need to be as structured. But when I work with families where children are in control to a certain degree, or parents have just really kind of lost their way in how to establish appropriate rewards and consequences, this can be really helpful. And it's just a very simple list of expectations. The most important one is safety. Above all, we need to make sure that our children are safe, and we need to encourage them to be safe themselves. That means no playing with fire, juggling knives, playing with razor blades, fire, other things like that. No drugs and alcohol, things of that nature. Secondly is respect. We need to encourage and demand that our children are respectful, not just verbally, but physically, and respectful to our property. Third is all basic rules for older kids and for younger kids to be obedient. Now, a lot of people don't like that word, but it's appropriate, I think, to use the word obey, which is basically do what you're told without complaining, dawdling, or rejecting it and or arguing. And then last, I think we need to train our children to be helpful contributors to the family. And so the last expectation is to do your fair share of work. And for younger children, that's just helping out with very minor chores. And for older children, it's chores plus doing the best that they can in school. And what I say is that the basic expectation for school is perfect homework completion on time and satisfactory, plus no test score below C. Now, that's provided that the child is reasonably capable, and we can certainly tailor that for children who struggle or are particularly gifted, then they should be getting, better grades on tests. So those are the four expectations. And as a major reward or as a basic reward, we want children to see that there will be a significant consequence, a positive consequence, when they meet those expectations to a reasonable degree, not perfectly, but reasonable degree. We give them certain things. And over the years, I've recognized that kids want essentially four things. They want our trust. They want to know that we trust them as human beings to make good choices. Secondly, they want respect. They want verbal respect. They want physical respect. They want to be treated, in essence, like real human beings who are highly valued. Third, they want certain freedoms. They want to go places. They want to be able to have more and more adult-like freedoms as they go older. And lastly, they want privileges. That's money, that's more tangible things like video games and going out and money for going to a movie and things like that. So those are the four rewards that I think that kids should be able to get and earn in order to feel empowered and like they've really gotten something. And I call it like a paycheck. Just like when I do work, I get paid. And most people, when they work, they get paid. Children should kind of get paid for doing what they ought to be doing. It sets up a system where they feel empowered again, and they know that they have predictability in their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad you clarified that the system you're putting out in the book is really for more for parents who have run amok on this issue of who's in charge of the family, and that there are a lot of parents who haven't run amok and may not have to follow this. But going forward, when parents are trying to reclaim their position as head of household, head of family, you then mm-hmm. suggest that they set up a constitution, a family constitution, which I experienced as essentially a redefinition or an agreement, a re-agreement about what's your job, what's mine, what's your responsibility, what's mine, what are your rewards, what are my rewards. Can you tell us a little bit more about that constitution and,
sure.
and why you created it?
Sure. Well, like any system, there needs to be a codification of whose role is what the responsibilities are, and what the boundaries are. And one of the biggest difficulties with parenting is, again, when we have one or two parents who aren't on the same page about things, there could be a lot of confusion. And when we have a document that codifies what those expectations and boundaries and rules and consequences are, then there's something to refer to, and it becomes less subjective because, let's face it, parenting can be a highly emotional thing. And if we run on emotion, we're going to often err on one side or the other. And if we codify something, then that communicates that not only is the system intact, but that mom and dad agree on what's going on, and there's something to refer to that isn't based on emotion, but it's based on something that we've already agreed upon. And I think that that's highly reinforcing, and I think it a lot of safety and predictability for families. When I deal with parents whose families kind of have, as you said, run amok, it's very encouraging when they can agree on a set of boundaries and limits and values and things like that. And oftentimes when they try to kind of stiffen and become a little bit firmer, a little bit stricter, they sometimes go to another extreme. And if we write down the expectations and the consequences, we can avoid that by saying, no, we agreed that when Junior doesn't get the homework completion for a week, we don't take away all of his privileges until kingdom come. You know, that's sometimes the impulse of the parent who's trying to get things under control, is they become uber parents and they want to, you know, become authoritarian, and I'm going to, you know, crush the child to get them to submit to me. And that's not the spirit of this at all. It's supposed to be reasonable and to a point where both parents agree. And so if there's a document that says we've already agreed that this is what is going to be the general consequence, both positive and negative, everybody knows what's going to happen. There's no confusion. They know to refer to when something happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when you're talking about instituting the Constitution in the family, you also talk about the backlash, essentially, that can happen from children reacting to the new restrictions. And that challenges me a little bit. One of the things that I learned to do with my children was that we would talk over, or we would let me give you an example. A dear and wise friend suggested to me when I went to her going, oh my God, I feel so overwhelmed. She suggested that I involve my children, who were at the time 5 and 12, in mm-hmm. Planning meals, buying the groceries, preparing the meals, and doing the cleanup. And I took this idea home and I offered it to my children. And I said, would you like to try it? And when we tried something, like as an experiment, we would do it for 3 weeks. Well, they enthusiastically said that they would like to try it for 3 weeks. And then at the end of 3 weeks, we would meet and say, okay, do you want to continue it? And I was drawing my inspiration from research that was done in corporations that said if you try to institute a change in a corporation from the top down, you get a lie-in to the change, then you don't get the resistance. So what do you think about a more graduated approach as opposed to this is the way we're doing it, sign here?
If it works, fantastic. I have no problem with that. I mean, let me use a different metaphor and go back to the speed limits. If the speed limit changes on the highway, and some people say, no, I don't like the new speed limit going from 65 to 55. Does that mean that we should involve people and say, well, you can have a choice here. You can drive, 65 if you want to. No, sometimes changes to a system need to be top down. Some things are non-negotiable. But to the degree that we can involve the children with decision making, there's nothing wrong with that fundamentally. And if you're going to get more buy-in to it, absolutely do it. I mean, especially with, changes like, who's going to be responsible for certain chores and any kind of system changes like that. I think it's great to involve the children. I actually recommend that. There's a couple opportunities when you're starting the Constitution to bring it to the children and say, here's what we're thinking about. What kind of changes would you like to make to this? Do you think that this is reasonable? And if the children are reasonable, if they're not grossly defiant, then it's absolutely sensible to take their suggestions into account and implement them as much as you can. I absolutely agree that that's a wonderful idea, but sometimes you're not going to be able to do that.
And I definitely agree with you. I have certainly worked with families where that would just be impossible. Their children would just go, no, I'm not doing it. Forget it.
Right,
forget
exactly.
You. Yeah, yeah.
Sure, so, I want to stay up until midnight and text my friends. And the parents need to say, well, how about 11 o'clock? How about time? No, sometimes no needs to be no, and you need to give me your cell phone by 9 o'clock because it's my job to make sure that you can regulate yourself. And if you can't do that on your own, then I have to step in. And that's where I think another part of my book is important, where to the degree that children show that they are regulating themselves, then the parents can and, in fact, should back off. Then you don't need to control them at all. Then it's wonderful to give them that kind of trust and respect and freedom. That's a joy as a parent. I don't have to convince my five-year-old even that it's time to go to bed at 8 o'clock. He just knows and he wants to go to bed. He's regulated, so I don't have to order him around or tell him the rule that you have to go to bed at 8 o'clock because he naturally does on his own. So I don't have to assert my authority in areas like that. And that's wonderful.
Great. Well, there are so many more things in your book, and I just want to point out that you have a discussion about spanking, about dating and the rules for dating, about dealing with video games and television and technology, about some ideas about single parenting. And I really like your discussion on dealing with other people's children. I think there's a lot of grief that goes on when people don't recognize that if other people's children are in their home, it's their responsibility to set some structure. And I like that. That always helped me a lot. Well, I really appreciate the pattern that you're offering, the structure that you're offering for parents who have not been able to establish a satisfying structure for themselves and their family, which you've done here in Desperately Seeking Parents. So I want to thank you for your work in both with families and in writing the book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And thank you so much for getting off the airplane and talking with us here today on Full Power Living.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. We'll talk again, perhaps. Thank
you. I hope so. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. And thanks to our wonderful producer, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for his longtime support and care of us here at Full Power Living. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention to what you want to become, not to what you want to overcome.
Living with Eileen Dillon.